Welcome to the SBS 318 Islamic Culture and Civilization program, brought to you live from the Cal State University Domingo Hills. And we welcome you. I'm your host and instructor, Sadullah Khan. In response to the 9/11 tragedy, there has been a renewed interest in Islam. On the one hand, there has been a tremendous amount of backlash in some parts of the country. And on the other, a willingness to share, to care, to learn, to understand, to interact, and to appreciate one another. On the one hand, we found a tremendous outcry that led in some ways to innocent people being victims of attacks. In fact, the first two people killed in America as a response to what happened were both Far Easterners. None of them were Muslim. This also indicates the degree of ignorance that we have of one another. Eminent Islamic scholars from North America gathered and immediately condemned the tragedy that happened at the hands of terrorists. In fact, great scholars from all over the world and religious leaders as well as political leaders unequivocally condemned these attacks. In fact, the Organization of Islamic Conference, representing 56 Islamic nations, had an emergency meeting in Doha in Qatar in the Middle East on October the 10th. And I quote what they agreed upon: "These terrorist acts contradict the teachings of all religions and of human moral values." Great scholars of Islam from the Middle East and North America gathered together on September 27th, and these scholars were Sheikh Yusuf Al-Qardawi, the Grand Islamic Scholar and Chairman of the Sunnah and Seerah Council in Qatar, the famous Judge Tariq Al-Bishri, as well as Dr. Muhammad Sayyid Al-Awa, Professor of Comparative Law and Sharia in Egypt, Dr. Haytham Khayyat, an eminent Islamic scholar from Syria, and Sheikh Taha Jabir Alwani, one of the great scholars of North America and chairperson of the North America High Council. And they agreed on the following: that these terrorist acts are considered by Islamic law to constitute the crime of Hirabah, waging war against society. The cooperation and the spirit of goodwill that also emanated from the tragedy has been unprecedented in the history of our land. I myself feared, when I observed what happened on that day, that there would be a backlash against Muslims in particular. But the backlash was much more minimal than what I expected. And, in fact, the goodwill was overwhelming. In some parts of the country, women of all faiths gathered and symbolically donned on the hijab, the head covering. And in some cases, Christians and Jews and people of other faith surrounded the mosques to escort Muslims to the masjid, to the mosque. And in some cases, even chaperoned the kids and escorted them to Muslim schools. The Catholic bishops and Muslim leaders issued a joint statement on the 14th of September in Washington. And noting the fact that Catholics and Muslims meet together regularly and engage in many civic projects, the statement read, "We believe that the one God calls us to be people of peace. Nothing in our holy scriptures, nothing in our understanding of God's revelation, nothing that is Christian or Islamic, justifies terroristic acts and disruption of millions of lives which we have witnessed this week. Together, We condemn those actions as evil and diametrically opposed to true religion. The Pope himself, Pope John Paul II, called for religious tolerance and stressed the Catholic Church's respect for Islam following the devastating terrorist attacks in the US. And he said, "I wish to reaffirm the Catholic Church's respect for Islam, for authentic Islam. The Islam that prays, the Islam that is concerned for those in need. Hatred and fanaticism and terrorism profane the name of God and disfigure the true image of man." It's in the light of this, and in the light of renewed interest in Islam, we found that in most cases, many bookstores had their books on Islam sold out. In some parts of California, there was a lack of Islamic literature available, and Qurans were sold out. I believe it appropriate at this moment in time, at this juncture in our history, at this crucial period, for us to reflect and understand each other. That we live here, we belong here, and we are part of a joint society, and we share partly a common legacy and are developing a common history and a common identity. It is with this also in mind that we have developed this program and provide this service to the community. And this cause, which we are presenting here through the SBS 318 at the Cal State University in Dominguez Hills, is aimed at offering a comprehensive introduction to the contemporary understanding of Islam. Muslims constitute 1/5 of the world's population. Muslims constitute majorities in many countries and significant minorities in most others. As an example, 100 million Muslims in India and over 65 million Muslims in China as minorities. Muslims also constitute well over 6 million adherents in the USA, making the second largest religion in America at present. What we hope to achieve through this cause over the next 12 to 13 weeks is to provide the students the information and for those who are interested to be better informed, an approach and a vehicle and a platform to develop an insight into one of the fastest growing faiths in the world, and more specifically growing in the Western world. To introduce the study of a faith and a tradition whose culture has increasingly become part of contemporary American landscape. To be provided with an academic foundation as well as intellectual tools for acquiring an appreciation of diverse ways of life. To have an enhanced understanding and to increase our knowledge and appreciation of the process of cultural and ideological development at a national and at an international level by studying a universal faith, while becoming acquainted with different philosophies, differing lifestyles, which influence the content and structure of a culturally pluralistic society. For those taking the course for credits, of course, the following criteria: we will be having two minor assignments or essays and one major essay, and I will inform you about this later on in the course. The consideration is that the papers which are presented should be well researched. I will look at whether the introduction describes a specific goal or a set of objectives. Does the body of the paper adhere to the goals put forth in the introduction? Are all sources listed in the bibliography? Is the use of sources strong and convincing? And how appropriate and complete are the sources for each footnote or endnote. And also, of course, linguistic and grammatical propriety. Through the next 13 weeks, we would be covering some of the major themes that will introduce us to various concepts of Islam and the Muslim world, Islamic thought, Islamic philosophy, Islamic belief and practice. And some of the course topics will include: why study an ideology other than your own? Why Islam? Defining Islam. The impact and influence of the personality and teachings of Prophet Muhammad on the contemporary world. The history of the Quran, as well as the sciences that evolved therefrom. The place of Quran in world literature. A critical overview of the sciences of prophetic traditions. Sources of Sharia, Islamic law, its objectives, and how often it's most misunderstood and feared. The approaches dealing with the phenomenon of spirituality in Islam and the appeal of spirituality to the modern mind. Major events in the history of Islam that had an impact on the world. Contribution of Islam as a civilization to the global heritage of civilizations. Moments in American Muslim history. Images of Islam and the Muslim identity in America. Some of the current issues and contemporary debates. The Abrahamic faiths, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, basis for dialogue and cooperation, as well as interfaith dialogue, and specifically looking at Los Angeles as a microcosm of the macrocosm. Two of the books that I request and prescribe, and that I believe would tremendously assist us in benefiting and appreciating and amalgamating with the lectures, would be: one is the book by John Esposito. It is Islam, the Straight Path, as well as the one by Akbar S. Ahmed, Islam Today. So the one, John Esposito, Islam, the Straight Path, as well as Islam Today, a short introduction to the Muslim world by Akbar S. Ahmed. When we come back after the break, we will go into the definition of culture, of ideology, of civilizations, and deal with why study an ideology other than our own. Don't forget, we have three guests: Dr. George Gross from the UCLA, Sheikh Yasir Fasaga from Mission Viejo, and Rabbi Arnold Reckless. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the SBS 318 course, directly delivered to you from the Cal State Domingo Hills University on DHTV. And to inform you a bit about myself, perhaps, I'm from South Africa formerly and based here in Los Angeles for the past 3.5 years. I'm presently the Executive Religious Director of Islamic Affairs at the Islamic Center of Irvine. I serve as Director of Muslim Affairs at USC. I lecture for the Academy of Judaic Christian and Islamic Studies at UCLA, where I also serve as an advisor to the Chancellor on the Committee and the Council of Religion, Ethics and Values. And of course, I teach the SBS 318 at the Cal State Domingo Hills University. We have spoken a bit about the renewed interest in Islam. In fact, statistics indicate that since September the 11th, over 36,000 people have embraced Islam in America. And these are statistics which are known. There are many which are, of course, undocumented. And this is unprecedented, too, in the history of Islam here in America. The renewed interest, the renewed concern, the increased interaction, and I think an increased appreciation of one another. I think on the one hand, the backlash led to a tremendous fear in the hearts of many Muslim people. On the other hand, it has led to a lot of hope that people are trying to understand, and it engages us as people of faith, people of morals and ethics, to learn to engage each other in a positive and a productive manner. And this university's response to 9/11 is part of that response and part of that tradition of trying to learn and know one another and appreciate the other. There are various avenues and sources for Islamic information, and one of the most appropriate and perhaps up-to-date, high-tech, cutting-edge is of course the internet, and one of the service providers for us, Islamicity, have provided a tremendous amount of service and information on Islam. And of course I think it will be appropriate for us here to have a look at Islamicity and what they are doing at this juncture.
Welcome to a .com that's not starving for attention. At IslamicCity.com, hits have more than doubled since September 11th, though many of the visitors that day sent messages like this: expletive Allah, expletive Muhammad, and expletive every one of you. That anger and ignorance shook the company's employees, who are proud of their website and the bridges it builds.
We're creating this community in cyberspace, you know, where Muslims, you know, can come and interact with each other, you know, have various needs fulfilled.
We called upon people to be guided to the
needs like streaming video, the Quran in different languages, Islamic children's songs can all be found on the website, which also sells dozens of books on the history of Islam and its teachings. Chief Executive Officer Mohammed Abdul Alim says IslamicCity.com is used in more than 100 countries. But many of the more recent visits have come from non-Muslims, and something surprising happened after the initial spate of hate. Support.
We want you to know that you are Americans too.
Alim says 90% of the letters are now overwhelmingly positive. The man who wrote the profanity-laced email wrote back, "I ask your forgiveness in what I have done. My anger was completely misplaced."
It is really surprising, and it is, I think, a testament to our nation, you know, where, you know, through this tragedy, you know, we're able to do some serious soul searching.
Those looking hard enough have found in Islam a community much like their own, filled with hard-working Americans trying to make a difference, and in the .com world trying to get noticed. Here, not a problem. Ted Chen, Channel 4 News.
And it really is a...
Okay. Thank you very much. Welcome back. I wish to inform you that, of course, I have a question here from Warren inquiring whether students will get credit for it in case they register. Yes, of course, if you register, this is a three-credit course, and I'll provide for you later information about this as well. And as you have seen in the Islamicity piece that we have shown you, that how people who were angered, and perhaps understandably so, and maybe vulgar, and not understandably so, nonetheless were able to be informed and thereafter rethink and reflect and be better informed. And this is part of the process, and this is part of the reason why we have this program. And therefore I advise you, we'll have the numbers and the information of the emails that you can send. And please feel free to call us in the number 800-339-1193. Call in, ask questions, post your comments if you wish, and enrich each other through our understanding and our questioning and our responses. Yes, this is a three-credit course, and over the next 13 weeks, we will be dealing with various questions that I've outlined and various themes that I've mentioned before. Now, to go into the course itself, I'll begin by looking at the whole question of ideology, because part of our discussion today in the initial stage would be, why study an ideology other than your own? The course is a part of a social behavioral science program, and it's called Islamic Culture and Civilization. What is ideology? What is culture? What is civilization? How do we engage these terms? How do we understand them? Now, despite a great diversity of opinion, most scholars share certain fundamental views about ideology. And this includes the notion that ideology represents a set of ideas, values, or assumptions which large numbers of people in a given society believe at any one time. The ideas, values, and assumptions are not innocent by themselves, nor straightforward truths, nor are they deceitful. But they grow out of social relations in such a way as to appear helpful and explanatory to people from various perspectives. So as we can see, ideas, values, and assumptions which large numbers of people share. When we look at the term culture itself, the term culture has been defined in various different ways. On the one hand, we find Max Weber, perhaps in jest, saying that man is an animal suspended in webs of chance that he himself has spun. I assume he meant culture to be those webs. But on a more serious note, Clyde Cushcon's Mirror of Man, he has laid down the following ideas and has forwarded some ideas and definitions regarding what culture is. Some say that culture is a way of life of people. Some others consider it a social legacy that the individual acquires from his or her group. Others consider it a way of thinking, a way of feeling, and a way of believing. Some consider it a storehouse of pooled learning, of shared learning. Some consider it learned behavior. Some consider it a mechanism for the normative regulations of behavior. But in all these definitions, what we find collectively, perhaps, is that culture is a system of shared beliefs, of shared values, of shared customs, of behaviors, and artifacts that members of a society use, utilize, employ to cope with their world and to cope with one another. And that these are transmitted from generation to generation through learning and the process of passing on the legacy. Culture then means a total body of tradition then, born by society, transmitted from generation to generation. And as Robert Murphy writes in his book Culture and Social Anthropology and Overture, he says, culture refers to the norms, values, and standards by which people act, and includes the ways distinctive in each society of ordering the world and rendering the world intelligible. Culture is a set of mechanisms for survival, but also provides us with a definition of reality. It is the matrix into which we are born. It is the anvil upon which our persons and destinies are forged. In defining culture then, it is important that we locate ourselves, our beliefs, our attitudes, our ethics, our assumptions, our prejudices, and our bias in relation to the culture we are studying, since culture is context specific, and engaging one another positively in our understanding of one another. Henry Ward Beecher is reported to have said, that is true culture, which helps us to work for the social betterment of all. When it comes to civilization, the verb civilize itself means to bring out of a primitive or savage state. It implies to educate, to enlighten, to refine, according to the American Heritage Dictionary. And civilized society is usually marked by progress in arts and sciences. Culture precedes civilization. And human society will have distinct meaning and systems, including language and religious systems, before these systems become institutionalized politically and socially, reflected as civilization. However, the fact that society becomes progressively more civilized does not in any way diminish the role of culture or the influence of culture. Civilization also is usually defined as a developed form of culture. So in other words, we can see civilization as a natural process of growth from culture. The famous historian Arnold Toynbee wrote at the conclusion of his study of human history, and he said regarding civilization, and I quote him, "Civilization is the endeavor to create a state of society in which the whole of mankind will be able to live together in harmony as members of a single, all-inclusive family, the goal at which all civilizations so far known have been aiming unconsciously, if not consciously." I repeat the last part. Civilization is the endeavor to create a state of society in which the whole of mankind will be able to live together in harmony as members of a single, all-inclusive family, the goal at which all civilizations so far known have been aiming, whether unconsciously, if not consciously. This in itself is a reflection of one of the statements of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who is reported to have said, "Al-khalqu kulluhum iyalullah, fahabbu al-khalqa ilayhi anfa'uhum li'iyali," or another one, "Khayrun nasi anfa'uhum lin-nas," translated meaning that all creation are part of those who are dependent, part of the family of God, if you will, and the best in the estimation of God are those who are best to his universal family, or in another tradition, the best of humanity, the best of human beings are those who are best to humanity. Now I want to focus on one of the major themes of tonight's discussion before we go interviewing our respected guests. And the major theme here for the first section would be, why study an ideology other than your own? Now, firstly, Geoffrey Pender states in his book, World Religions, From Ancient History to the Present, he states regarding fidelity and infidelity, because very often it's assumed that if you study an ideology other than your own, you are being untrue to your faith. Geoffrey Pender states, "To study a different religion need not mean infidelity to one's own faith." This is the first point. "But rather that our own understanding may be enlarged by seeing how other people have sought for reality and have been enriched by their search." So this is the first point, that studying a faith other than our own doesn't mean that we are unfaithful to ours if we have a belief system or an ideology that we particularly follow or that we adhere to. Secondly, knowledge leads to understanding. And this is very crucial in a pluralistic society, specifically in America, and the fact that we are living in an increasingly global village, an ever-increasing manifestation of a global village. So knowledge leads to understanding, and understanding to tolerance of people with a different viewpoint. And civilized people, part of the matrix, part of the mentality of civilized people, of being civilized, a part of the nature of being civilized, is the ability to understand that people do differ, and that we expect people to differ, and we accept their differences, though we don't accept those ideas for ourselves or as being the best ideas or the best philosophy in itself, but we understand that there are differences, and we engage one another in a positive manner regarding those differences. Thirdly, can someone study a religion other than their own? Can one truly study something which one doesn't believe in? So the third point I want to bring is a point which is raised by Professor Ismail Farooqi, the late Professor Ismail Farooqi. He states in his book Islam that the question has been asked, can someone understand a religion in which he or she does not believe? Yes. Belief in the truth claims of a religious tradition is not a prerequisite for engaging in the study of that faith. In other words, it does not imply that we have to be members of a particular faith in order for us to appreciate, to understand, to negotiate the faith. So belief is not a prerequisite for understanding the faith. The fourth point is, the study of another religious tradition should enhance our own understanding. Studying of another religious tradition should enhance our own understanding of our own faith. Very often we understand ourselves better in relation to others. And even for the non-believer or the agnostic, the study of religion should open up new dimensions of the human spirit. Fifthly, the objective study of religion or of faiths or of ideologies should be taken because of its inherent significance. And this is the fifth point. The inherent significance of understanding of culture, of understanding of societies, of understanding the variety that is reflected in humanity. Sixth, that such inquiry should open to us what we share in common. What we share in common with people of other faiths, of other traditions, of other ideologies, and of other perspectives. And at the same time, we also see what is genuinely unique about our own. And perhaps, in this manner, impact positively on those who may have a different perspective and also appreciate our uniqueness. So, this inquiry opens up what we share in common, our commonalities. At the same time, it also brings to our attention and brings to our focus what is genuinely unique in our own. The seventh point is that the study of religion or the study of ideologies or the study of faiths in general, is it relevant today at the beginning of the 21st century? The answer, of course, is a resounding yes. The very fact that people turn to faith in such great numbers, with such great passion, after the September 11th tragedy, indicates that yes, we are after all a people of faith. That faith plays an important role. That though we may not go to church or synagogue or mosque or temple as often as we ought to or as required by our religious traditions, but inherently we are people of faith. The United States, and indeed the world at large, is undoubtedly in the midst of a profound transition period. And the study of religion is most relevant. The study of ideology, of philosophy, most relevant, more so than ever before. The crisis confronting nations today cannot be reduced merely to economic inflation, to political instability, and social upheaval. It's also one of values, one of convictions. And therefore, the serious study of ideologies, of philosophies, and of religion and faiths in the world today is not only legitimate, not only required, but in fact absolutely necessary. Today, we need, without doubt, all the forces we can muster in order to restore a sense of individual worth, of moral community, and of value direction. The sympathetic study of faiths, even other than our own, of ideologies, even other than our own, or religions for that matter, can contribute to the awareness towards these goals and can be of assistance in helping us to recover an awareness of our common humanity. Our common humanity, which has so long been overshadowed by our preoccupation with technological and material achievement. As has so often been said, we have conquered outer space at the expense of inner space. The eighth point is, and the question is often asked, but why study, living in America, why study a non-Western religion? We are living, after all, in the West. I think the question in itself is an improper question, is an invalid question. If you refer to Christianity, it's not a Western religion. It had its origins in the same area, in the locality where Judaism had its origins and Islam has its origins. And in fact, they share a common history and a common legacy, very intertwined and inseparable. So when we say Western religion, we are talking about perhaps the European world, But when you look at the rest of the globe, people of the Christian faith, over 2 billion, 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide, and 15 million Jews, we find that, of course, it's a global community. It's not a Western or non-Western phenomena. It's a global phenomena, and more specifically so in the case of Christianity and Islam, which has amongst them 3.3 billion followers worldwide, approximately half or more than half the population of the world. So the studying of a non-Western religion, I think the question is improper and in fact irrelevant. We no longer live in relative isolation. We are living in a global village. Rather than looking, therefore, at religions as some form of a reflection of a foreign culture or a foreign tradition, and failing to acknowledge the reality that in a plural society, and more specifically, we find ourselves in Southern California and in Los Angeles, which is perhaps the most cosmopolitan city in the world, everyone is the other, and every other has become we. So, rather than looking at ideologies and philosophies and faiths embedded in these cultures as quaint or bizarre, we should seek genuine understanding of each other. And this is a twofold enterprise. This is a twofold enterprise. Engaging the ideologies, the philosophies and the faiths as they are, practiced by the people who believe and follow those traditions, and also at the same time engaging ourselves in the light of that and those traditions and those philosophies and ideologies. After all, we live in a shared world, in a very, very shared world. The world gets smaller by virtue of ever faster travel and by this instantaneous communication that we have with internet as well as with the telephone and television. We virtually watch the world unfold, events unfold in our living room. So there's no East and West anymore to the world. And the ideologies or philosophies that may have originated anywhere else, that are an integral part of our culture, our civilization, our belief and our practices here, are inherently part, therefore, of wherever we are and wherever we find ourselves. They are not foreign. They are here. And the very fact that we are here as people of faith, as people of following ideologies and religions and cultures, is a manifestation to that truth and that reality. The question then arises then, why study Islam? Islam is that religious movement that began, not necessarily in Arabia, by the way. Since we have a shared legacy, it started long before. It's believed that, according to Islamic belief and Islamic tradition, that from the time of Adam, peace be upon him, and Muslims bear with me, whenever we make reference to prophets of God, messengers of God like Adam, Noah, Jesus, Moses, Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, Muhammad, we say peace be upon them as a mark of respect. That all of these were divine emissaries who came to guide humanity throughout history. And according to Muslim belief, culminating in the mission of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who received, according to Muslim belief, the final revelation, which is the Quran. But we share with the people of the book, the Jews and the Christians, a common heritage and a common legacy. And this Islam, which sort of manifested itself more pronouncedly in the 7th century Arabia, spread around the world, becoming one of the world's major religions. And part of our program, part of our course, would be to look at how this movement began, where it is practiced today, what are the fundamentals of its faith, who are the key figures, what is its scripture, what does it say, how is it used and abused, what is the current Muslim population, what does it mean to be a Muslim? These are questions relating to the phenomenon of Islam. Of course, there are over 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide today. Not only do they represent all known races of humanity, but they inhabit a nearly continuous stretch of land from the shores of Atlantic in the west to the confines of China and Malaysia in the east, and much of Africa from the central to the north. In our approach to try to understand one another, in our shared civilizations, in our shared culture, which is now becoming part of our heritage as Americans here, I will present to you in the next hour interviews with renowned scholars of Islam, Christianity and Judaism. And I begin with a great and dear friend, Rabbi Arnold Reckless, who is from the University Synagogue in Irvine and who I interviewed a few days ago, asking him some pertinent questions which we are dealing with tonight. I hand you over to the Honorable Rabbi Arnold Reckless from the University Synagogue in Irvine.
Thank you for having us at the University Synagogue, Rabbi Reckless, and it's indeed a privilege to be here.
It's my pleasure.
Rabbi, in dealing with the program of studying an ideology other than our own, the importance of civilization, the understanding of how civilizations impact upon one another, and in a plural society like America, specifically in Los Angeles, where we have a tremendous amount of variety, and specifically in the Judeo-Christian or the Abrahamic tradition, Muslim Christians and Jews, this is somewhat an inherent part of our tradition. I mean, you have the idea in Islam, the idea of Ahlul Kitab. It implies much more than we do. Unfortunately, we say much about religion, we don't always do it. How important do you think it is for us to study an ideology other than our own?
Well, I think we're very fortunate to live in America where interfaith dialogue, intercultural dialogue is seen as a virtue. It's not a matter of tolerance or necessity only. It's a matter of realizing we're part of this great mosaic of both Western religions, the people of the book religions you mentioned, of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and also of Eastern religions. And I always find that I understand Judaism better, understand other religious traditions better. First of all, when participating in interfaith dialogue, I'm forced to reflect on things that I say reflexively. You know, I'm used to speaking about Judaism all the time, but the question of a non-Jew can sometimes get me to think in a whole new way about something I just took for granted or I haven't thought about since I was a child or a young adult. So it's the question of the outsider, so to speak, but the concerned outsider, the learned outsider, the curious outsider, that makes me think about my own tradition even more deeply. So that's one benefit of interfaith dialogue. Another is that I really do believe that in interfaith dialogue, we learn about aspects of our tradition that are muted, that are not so overt. But as we see them in other traditions and see how well they function there, we begin to say, maybe we should stress meditation more, or we should stress fasting more, or look at Ramadan. I mean, a whole month, you know, Yom Kippur is one long day, but look at Ramadan. Look at the dedication of Muslims who get up before the sun comes up and fast. So that's very inspiring as well, to understand what someone's tradition means to them, to see aspects of it that are muted or not as overt in our own, and to give renewed emphasis to them. And then other times, there are aspects of other religious traditions that aren't muted, they're just not there, but they could be there. They're not forbidden by a particular religious tradition. And we begin to say, maybe we should pay attention to that more.
And of course, the very fact share common space. And beyond that, as you mentioned, there are various traditions that are very common.
Yes.
Our history is virtually, you know, from one root.
Right.
And I think, interestingly enough, though there is a commonality, even on those issues about which we differ, there's a commonality about some of those things we need to look at as well. Sometimes, for example, you spoke about the issue of fasting, or we may have a difference in... But the emphasis, the spiritual dimension, which people are so much yearning for, over and above the legal dimension upon which we differ, the technical aspects, you'll find that the higher, the purpose behind it, the principle behind it, are very unifying. And sometimes, in times of conflict, when you engage one another, or even in times of debate,
yes,
if you put an open heart and open mind, you realize that, wait a minute, we are aiming towards the same thing. We're not as different as we thought we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, in fact, when you say in times of disagreement, We understand that the disagreements are between and among cousins and brothers and sisters. It's not as if it needs to be polarizing. It becomes interesting. It becomes a mosaic or a tapestry. And it's true, we're not always going to agree on religious ideas, but we can agree on the benefits of pluralism. We can learn how to listen. You know, one of the things we learn in colleges and graduate schools and seminaries, unfortunately, is how to take apart an idea, how to debate it, how to come up with the right answer. One of the skills we don't learn so well, they do that better, I think, in Eastern religious traditions, is how to listen meditatively, how to listen intensely, where you're not trying to figure out who's right, you're just trying to learn. You're just trying to listen. And one of the benefits, I think, for in a group of people who really want to learn from each other is they just have to almost step back and learn how to listen. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of compare and contrast. It's a matter of the awe mm-hmm. and the wonder in each tradition. And if we hear that, we care very little about comparing and contrasting. We want to learn from the power, that spirituality.
So, it's, you know, the listening is not to engage, to prepare the next point and to right. shut down the other person, rather, but to be reflective and introspective, and the process to grow.
Yeah, it's really therapeutic listening.
And enriching
yes,
as well.
It really is.
As students, I mean, at university level, at tertiary level, what is the significance in studying, even academically studying in religion? There may be people who hold a particular faith, or people who have no faith at all. They may be agnostic or atheistic. Why is it important, do you feel, that you know that even then, since we live in a shared world, why is it important even then, despite me not holding a particular tradition, or not being interested in the various traditions that exist, why should I then study an ideology other than what I hold?
Well, we live in a diverse country, and whether people claim to be religious or not, or spiritual or not, they come from some culture, and in their cultural norms, in their sociological norms, even if not in their theological norms, they are creating a society and a subculture that flows from those traditions, those countries from which they came, religious traditions from which they came. We can understand people better if we understand their culture, even if they no longer practice it actively. That's one reason. I think another one is just to expand our own worlds. We can't really claim to understand life itself if we don't spend time trying to understand how different groups have come to try to understand life. I mean, what is religion essentially? I'm now using Clifford Geertz, the sociologist, to look at religion. It is a desire to impose cosmos chaos, mm-hmm. that we live with such chaos in our lives, in our culture. And there's a human need, a deep human need, a spiritual need that is at the, I really think, at the core of every religious experience, to have some way to interpret the world. That search is shared by people, whether they're called religious or not. Some people think it's psychological, some people think sociological, others think it's a religious search, but it is this shared human need to impose cosmos order on chaos. And by understanding what different religious systems have said, we get closer to the truth. Yes.
Yeah. Beautifully said, Rabbi.
That was Rabbi Arnold Reckless from the University Synagogue in Irvine, sharing some thoughts on some of the issues that we are dealing with here today. Before we go to the break, I wish to just mention about our next guest, which we'll be having live in the studio, Dr. George Gross, from the Academy of Judeo-Christian Islamic Studies at UCLA. And I wish to quote something which he wrote, A Theology for September 11th. Don't forget, when we come back, you can call us at 800-339-1193. 800-339-1193. Please, awaiting your calls, any comments, any contributions, any questions that you may have regarding the topic. Dr. George Gross wrote, A Theology for September 11th. God is not the fruit of our piety. A great nation is not above God. A great nation is not, by its greatness, God's co-equal. As we go forth to extirpate evil, we dare not arrogate to ourselves the right to overlook our own evil. The God of history drops his plumb line to measure our stewardship of the great power which, by his providence, he has vouchsafed to our care. God is not mocked. In 1867, during the war between the states, Abraham Lincoln wrote, "I know that the Lord is always on the side of the right, but it is my consistent anxiety and prayer that I and this nation should be on the Lord's side." Let not the song "God Bless America" be a claim to cheap grace. It is a grievous mistake to call our war against terrorism a crusade. But all the world enjoys crusades, in particular Jews and Muslims who remember. Better we go out listening to the God of Abraham. Abraham. The lineaments of Abraham are in Moses' face. The lineaments of Abraham are in the face of Jesus Christ. The lineaments of Abraham and the face of Muhammad. To the Almighty, the nations are as a drop in the bucket. But the God of Abraham holds us in a fraternity that is yet to be. Can Judaism, Christianity, and Islam repent and each seek a new configuration from the one with whom we have to do? Dr. George Gross, September 16th, 2001, A Theology for September 11th. We'll be having Dr. George Gross after the break. Don't miss it. Welcome back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills, the DHTV program, live here from Cal State University, and we are dealing with a university's response to 9/11 and the cause Islamic culture and civilization under the Social Behavioral Science Department here at CSU DH. We'll be taking your calls at 800-339-1193. But now I have the privilege and the honor of introducing a great friend and a colleague and a mentor in some ways at times, the head of the Academy of Judaic, Christian and Islamic Studies at UCLA, Dr. George Gross. Welcome, Dr. Gross.
Thank you, Sheikh Sadullah Khan.
It's a pleasure to have you, and is my first guest in the first program.
We've been through many good things together, and this will be another one, I'm sure.
Hopefully, I'm sure. Doctor, let me begin out by asking the question. You have heard some of the discussion we had about culture and civilization, as well as about what Dr. Rabbi Reckless has said.
Yes.
Are we en route to a clash of civilizations?
I think we have been clashing civilizations for a long time. It may be in a somewhat different form today, but nevertheless, we can go back and see the clash between Judaism and Christianity, as Christianity emerged, then with the coming of Islam as an historic religion, there are new elements of clash. Now it's a threefold clash. I think our task is to see in the midst of this clash, what is positive? What is the good to be brought out of these competing visions of God and understanding of human life? I think they are in competition. And it calls to mind the great play, Lessing's play, Nathan the Wise. Gotold Ephraim Lessing was the leader of the intellectual movement called the Enlightenment in Europe and America, and he was a German pastor's son, and he wrote this play based on the story of the Three Rings. Mm-hmm. And the father gave identical rings to three boys. He loved them equally. Then he died, and each one thought he was the head of the family because he had the ring. It went to court, and the judge said, "There's nothing we can say about this because your father's not here to speak and tell us." But then he went on to give his judgment. He said, "The true ring will be worn by the brother who loves the other brothers best. So the competition is not to destroy, but to love. Mm-hmm. Who will be the greatest lover of the three? That will be the test of truth in this matter.
Yes. So the clash in itself, I mean, you say there has been a constant clash. Could we perhaps replace the word somewhat, maybe I'm trying to modify it in such a way that it seems less aggressive perhaps, but maybe it's not completely realistic, but throughout the history. Isn't it maybe ways that we have engaged one another, not always in a most productive and encompassing manner, that, you know, despite the commonalities, you know, the diversity is not as great as the commonalities. Despite that, maybe we haven't learned how to engage one another. Maybe this opportunity of being part now of a global village gives us the opportunity now to engage one another, not as clashing civilizations with armies and heads of states, but rather as people with a shared common vision of the future, with a great, tremendous shared heritage in ideology and philosophy and in morals and ethics. So maybe an opportunity to engage one another rather than a clash. Would you think that would be appropriate, or is that non-realistic?
I think we have to be realistic about the clash matter, because if we don't, we can make big mistakes. To modify a clash into a healthy competition or a blessed engagement, mm-hmm. if we look toward a blessed engagement, that would be certainly what we want instead of confrontation, a blessed engagement. Mm-hmm. And I think we experience that, you and I and our Jewish colleagues, when we have our dialogues.
Yes.
It's a blessed situation. In fact, mm-hmm. I recall Rabbi Michael Gottlieb said it was a holy time when these three Abrahamic religions engage in dialogue.
Yes.
And that doesn't have to be done only by scholars in the field. But it's only when it's done three out of three with openness of heart.
Of course, when we look at the way the world is moving right now, in fact, I look at the Oxford lecture given by Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, in 1993, which made great headlines worldwide. And it was vividly indicative of perhaps the trend of embracing one another somewhat. And you know, his crown title is Defender of the Faith. And he requested that it be changed to Defender of Faith rather than Defender of the Faith. In other words, not a particular faith, rather of faith in general. And he specifically mentioned Islam as one of the faiths of Britain. Now, looking at that, as well as the idea that, you know, we know, of course, Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington all attempt to contemplate somewhat a conflict between civilizations as the latest phase in the evolution of conflict in the modern world. At the moment, it seems, in according to their prediction somewhat, there is an envisaged clash between the West and Islam. Now, is that the case? Do you see that really playing out? Is that really so? Or is it just a misplacement of powers and how they interact with one another and engage one another?
As I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. I think the clashing is real. Mm-hmm. Our task is to do what we can to modify that clash, mm-hmm. to change it into something creative rather than destructive.
Redirect, perhaps.
Well, make it creative.
Okay.
Make it produce good.
Yeah, okay.
I don't see it as the West and the rest.
Yes.
Because for one thing, as you pointed out, these religions emerged in the Near East, mm-hmm. at their beginnings. But the West is more than one culture in itself.
Yeah.
And certainly we must include Judaism as a culture.
Of course.
So we really have these three cultures, and it's our brief that it's always three out of three. And to think of it as any two out of three is to skew the results. It's to mm-hmm. distort the picture,
mm-hmm.
To give an imbalanced take on reality, because if two are engaged in something, say Jews and Christians, the third, the Muslims, are looking over the shoulder.
Yeah.
Or if the Muslims are engaged with the Jews, the Christians are looking over the shoulder, and so it goes. The third is always there.
I like the quote that you always make, you know, wait a moment, wait a year, a day, the one that you always mention about
yes, wait a
the
moment.
Famous George Grosz quote.
Wait a moment, wait a day, wait 1,000 years, and the third will appear.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is.
That's my question. Hasn't the time come now that we are moving from the Judeo-Christian tradition to an Abrahamic and all-inclusive Abrahamic tradition, which is the way it's supposed to have been? Because when you look at Western, somehow the Judeo-Christian is seen as representing the moral and ethical values of the West. This is the problem that I have, that we find that though both are from the Near East, as you mentioned, as well as Islam, and they share a common legacy, I mean, an intertwined, inseparable legacy. Yet, the idea of maybe moving from the idea of Judeo-Christian, somewhat also meaning European and Western, the very fact that you call it Western and Islam, mm-hmm. I think that this must know in itself. I think perhaps moving from that wouldn't be that one step in the direction of redirecting or being creative towards making it a more feasible alternative and a better platform for the future.
If we translate the vision of it's always 3 out of 3 into these cultural terms, certainly we have a Judeo-Christian Islamic culture right now in the United States, because Islam, the newest of the newcomers, mm-hmm. is here, and so to speak, is looking over our shoulder all the time. That is for the Jews and the Christians, because we belong together, and it's built in that it will be a Judeo-Christian Islamic civilization.
Yeah.
We merely have to look for the signs of it, because it's there.
Okay. In fact, I'm looking at what the former president of Bosnia Herzegovina, Ali Izetbegovic, said. He said, the kinship, now referring to the two, by the way, and I know it doesn't please you very much to look at any two without the third, but at least the fact that there is an engagement, because very often when we speak of the Islam in the West, well, the Judeo-Christian is thrown in, but it's more seen as being the Christian West, European West. So he says the kinship that is Islam and Christianity, if you draw all the necessary conclusions from it, could direct the relations of these two great world religions to an entirely new dimension in the future. As Islam in the past was the intermediary between the ancient cultures in the West, as Islam in the past was the intermediary between the ancient cultures and the West, it must again today, in a time of dramatic dilemma and alternatives, shoulder its role as intermediary nation in a divided world. This is the meaning of the third way, or rather what he called the Islamic way. Islam and the world civilizations have the same roots, though Islamic history has been obscured behind the veil of fear or misunderstanding. And furthermore, we find, of course, recently duly testified by a Western academic in a documentary aired by PBS recently, very famous one they had recently, the Islam Empire of Faith, which I think was an excellent production. And Ben Kingsley quotes what the professor wrote, from the way we heal the sick and to the numerals we use for counting, cultures across the globe have been shaped by the Islamic civilization. Now, I'm not trying to emphasize the role of Islamic civilization. I'm have a course in that, or a theme on that, in the third or fourth week of our course. But what I think is that maybe a new attitude that provides the philosophic underpinning and emotional climate which encourages a kind of a new partnership. We cannot forget the past. We cannot even forget the present. But on what do we build the future? Can we go back to our shared common legacy, not our common engagement with one another, which was very hostile very often, but our shared common legacy, our shared common heritage, our past, the best of our legacy, our golden ages, especially our ideas and ideals, because the beginnings are the same. The center, the middle, has been way off from what the beginnings indicated, and the ending is not what we have at the present. So could we look perhaps back into the legacy and with a leap from then try to prepare for the future, though be grounded in the present? Is that possible, do you think?
I think it's possible and very necessary, and you're right. I see it as 3 out of 3 at all times, and I think it is a mistake, a very serious mistake, to leave out any one of the three partners. And I don't see Islam as the chief mediator between the three. I see each of them as mediator to the other. And what I would really hope for is a renewal of Islamic civilization. So no one will be tempted to say there is a civilization and it's the Western civilization, because there are other civilizations. And Islam reached its zenith, one zenith, mm-hmm. in the late Middle Ages, but it's time now for Islam to reach another zenith. And I would welcome that.
Just but as part of a shared legacy, not as an Islamic thing within an Islamic world or a Muslim world or in the Middle East, but something which is accepted and fostered within the general global environment, the global village.
I think there's a great deal that needs to be done by each community. Paul Tillich had the phrase prophetic self-criticism. So it's not for me as a Christian to say to a Muslim or to Islam, this is what you ought to do. Mm. No. It's for Muslims to determine what their renewal, what form their renewal will take. And it's for Christians to determine what form their renewal will take, and for Jews to determine what form Judaism will take in renewal. And each of these three communities profoundly need renewal. And I think, as you were pointing toward, it really isn't productive for them to think they can do it alone. We have to do it together. And yet we should not be really at some point telling one another what to do about it. But I'm quite convinced that each of these religions falls short of what they were intended to be. And so each needs to, as you said, we would say go back to the fountainhead. This was part of the Protestant Reformation. It was the attempt to go back to the scripture, the earliest form of the deposit of information and so on about the life and teachings and death and resurrection of Jesus, and go back there for renewal in the original languages. Mm-hmm. So to reinvigorate each of these cultures is a profound need at this time, and no one should think that any one of them does not need renewal. Each one desperately needs renewal, so there's no place for arrogance or pride in any of these communities, as far as I'm concerned. They each have such desperate needs for new life.
And can be fostered and watered by the gardens of one another. If we shared water, it can be a beautiful garden, I think. You know.
I like your imagery.
We are with Dr. George Gross from the Academy of Judaic Christian Islamic Studies at UCLA, a great scholar and writer as well as a teacher and a great friend. One of course, your favorite subjects, you said, please, you want that too. And I said, it's on there, Abraham.
It is.
Abraham.
It is.
Now, more than half of humanity, you know, the Muslims and Jews and Christians, we share Moses, we share Adam, and we share with the Christians Jesus, and we share with ourselves Muhammad. But the previous ones are common. But the one that we share all together is Abraham, the greatest of those that we share, I suppose. Now, more than half of humanity, over 2 billion Christians, 1.2 billion Muslims, at least 15 to 20 million Jews worldwide, respect and rate the father, patriarch, the spiritual ancestor of our faiths. The Quran elevates Abraham as a ummah. You know, he is referred to as a community by himself, a title which God has given to no one, not even Prophet Muhammad or Jesus, peace be upon both of them. Inna Ibrahim kana ummatan qanitan lillahi hanifa. Ibrahim surely was an ummah by himself. Now, Muslims describe themselves as a global community of faith. And this word ummah is referred to as one man, one person. It's a tremendous, tremendous honor, a tremendous title to be given to a person that he himself was considered an ummah. And of course, he was the father of many ummahs that came after that. I mean, and here we are. And we are his faith is not referred to as any particular faith, but as Hanif, as the pure one. And this is the reason why I perhaps ask, going back to the original, you know, though grounded in our own traditions and our own perspectives, yet find in that the Abrahamic message. Is even referred to as Khalil. And remember once you called upon me and said, is this the word that the Quran uses? You recall last year sometime, I think it was. Khalil is God's friend. Is that what the Quran says? Is that the word it uses? Now, Abraham is part of our philosophy. He is somewhat our philosophy and our culture in many ways, our shared philosophy and culture. And of course, at the Academy of Judaic Christian Islamic Studies, studying of the Abrahamic traditions, and also our, of course, our trip to Turkey, which we can speak about. Abraham is not sufficiently on the center stage. Is that perhaps part of the problem amongst the three?
Yes, it is. I know of the great remembrance of Abraham in the prayers in the mosque and the other prayers that Muslims pray five times a day. And I know that the feast at the end of the pilgrimage period is a celebration of Abraham. I know these things. I think what is at issue is Abraham a Jew? Is he a Christian? Is he a Muslim? If he is any one of the above, it's a problem. Because such an expression is to say he's ours, he belongs to us.
And not to you.
And not to you. Mm-hmm. And that's been the history of it. Because there is an implied recognition of some sort in there if we say Abraham is shareable and he can be shared with the others. Mm-hmm. The others who claim him, each one. Mm-hmm. And I think it's instructive to know that there's no tribe named after him. Mm-hmm. See, there are Israelites named after Israel.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, yeah.
Jacob, Israel, and so it goes.
Yes.
But there are no Abrahamites.
Yes.
He's free and clear in the sense of being identified with one group.
Or pegged down.
He's not pegged down, no. And to share Abraham is the beginning of a reconciliation in the Abraham family, to share him. And I have come upon an ethic based on Abraham. The Old Testament Genesis calls upon the human race to bless Abraham.
Yes.
And if Abraham is blessed, then the people who bless him in turn will be blessed. Mm-hmm. And it gets very severe. It says, those who curse Abraham will be cursed. It's a very strong statement there in Genesis 12. Yes. Now, what does it mean to bless Abraham? Well, the same passage says that all nations, all communities will be blessed through Abraham's descendants. And you've spoken of the Quran on the matter of Abraham is an ummah in himself. Mm-hmm. Then to bless Abraham is to bless his descendants. That is to bless one another. That's the only way to bless Abraham, is to bless one another. And that we need to explore with all diligence and openness of heart.
In fact, there's a verse in the Quran which of course makes reference to Abraham being Muslim in the sense that a submitter, not rather as a Muslim, as belonging to a particular category. And he says, "Ma kana Ibrahimu Yahudiya wala Nasraniya wala kin kana Hanifan Muslima." But he says, and it says he was neither a Christian nor a Jew, but he was a Hanif, submitting to God. So here the Muslim doesn't necessarily refer to a Muslim practicing a particular school of thought, but he referred to as Hanif, for example.
We have to be careful with that because it can be taken as meaning he was a Muslim.
Of course,
historically.
But what I mean, the emphasis here is on the Hanif, the pure part.
Yes, it is.
And somewhat we have lost that, you know, the innocence and the purity.
Yes.
I think this is part of the retreating that purity.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Because neither in the Jewish tradition, nor in Islamic tradition, nor in the Christian tradition, are found in essence those principles and values which could support the kinds of many things, the crusades that we did, the bombings that we do, the imprisonment and the oppression that we do of people today or in the past, for example. So I think that part of that innocence of who Abraham really was, he was neither Jew nor Christian nor Muslims, the way you are Jew, Christian or Muslims. He was a Hanif, upright. And I think the act is for us to become Hanif, come pure. If you are truly a Christian, are you really a follower of a believer in God, a manifester of true values? I think that kind of thing comes out. So the emphasis on Hanif, I think, is very, very unique. And also the term Khalil, I think, implies a friend of God. And almost as we say, if you befriend him, you are a friend of God too. You know, somewhat.
Yes, it goes together.
Yeah.
And being a friend of God is found in two places in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, and it's found in the letter of James in the New Testament. Yes. So we share this understanding that Abraham is God's friend.
Yes.
And in fact, he's God's first friend.
Yes. And a friend of a friend is a friend, isn't it?
That's the way it works.
So, and we should befriend the friends of one, to become friends of one another, so we are friendly to one another and be friends of the friend of the friend of God.
That's right.
So that's the way to go, I think. One of the other issues that I would look at, I began with a quote. We are talking to Dr. George Gross from the Academy of Judaic-Christian and Islamic Studies at UCLA. One of the things I want to bring about Abraham, I had the honor and the privilege of traveling with you to Turkey, was it last year? Year before last year? Oh, damn good.
2000.
2000. We are in 2002, are we? My time goes. We traveled to Ur in Turkey.
Yes.
And at the place of Abraham's birth, a historic place of Abraham's birth, and it was such a wonderful opportunity for Jewish, Christian and Muslim scholars from all over the world to gather together and go to those ancient sites. And there was something very spiritual just about being there. I remember the afternoon spent just walking in the area. It was just unbelievable. And one of the unique things, and I think one of the issues that I think that is very unique in what you do at the Academy, is that we found there that we engage in dialogue. We went to a conference which was supposed to be a dialogue on Abraham, about what we share in common, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. what we differ about, and how mm-hmm. we understand one another, and even mm-hmm. about the differences, about those things that are common to us. We all agree that Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his son, but we differ which son, perhaps. For example, the majority of Muslims hold it was Ishmael, not Isaac. For example. So we share the idea that Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his son. That's common to all of us. Mm-hmm. Abraham, his sacrifice is even common to us. We commemorate it as Eid al-Adha, as you mentioned early on. But we differ, perhaps. So even in our commonalities, there are differences. And sometimes in our differences, there are commonalities. But what I found very, very unique at that time was that we were the only ones doing the dialogue. That everyone was doing a multi-monologue, if that's the proper word. That each one was speaking, 10 people speaking.
I'm glad you spoke of that.
Yeah.
Because the Turks, in responding to what we did in the correspondence, it came to be thanking us for what we did. They pointed that out, and they were so grateful for what we did. The conference was called, in fact, the Abraham Symposium, which infers dialogue,
yes.
or the Abraham Dialogue, but indeed we were the only ones who did one.
Engaged in it, yes.
The other were traditional academic papers,
yes.
done one after another all day long for several days. So we were told that our work was the climax of the conference.
It was, but I remember the headline said "Bu bir divrem." It was the Zaman, the famous, you know, the well-known, respected national Turkish paper had the headlines "Bu bir divrem." And we asked, "What is it?" Said, "It's a revolution," and it was,
well,
you know, referring to the
Rabbi,
dialogue.
I must mention our mutual friend, Dr. Uri Gordon, former
yes.
ambassador from Israel to Turkey. He said it was like the landing on the moon.
Yes.
He compared it with that historic event of the
yeah.
astronauts landing on the moon. That's
yeah.
what he thought our dialogue
yeah.
was, and he was amazed, and he was so appreciative that what had been developed in Southern California could be effective in Southern Turkey.
In halfway around the world.
Halfway around the world, and the place of Abraham's birth.
I think we have the headline, I think, of the Zaman magazine, where it
yes,
says,
we do.
Buber Diverin and Ibrahim Hayachan, but it was all about the symposium about Abraham and about the revolutionary nature of that dialogue. Perhaps we could have that on the television screen shown to the people, perhaps. This is the one we're referring to. Buber Diverin, there we have it, Buber Diverin, and of course, it was. I remember that front picture was the headlines of that last day of the conference. It was so overwhelming. But coming to the point in itself, and there's a clearer picture of what we see there, that it says Buber Diverin, which means it is a revolution.
All right, and there's a second picture also, which we
yes.
might have.
Yes, I think we have the other picture as well, which is the one on
yes.
Ibrahim Hayachan, which is the other headline.
Abrahamic enthusiasm, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So enthusiasm for Abraham, yes. What I think is that that this issue of dialogue, that there's no real dialogue taking place. There's a series of monologues where we sit together and say, I would say, and you listen, and we talk at one another rather than to one another.
Well, I would offer also that the present growing interest in Islam on the part of
there we have
Christians.
It, the headlines you mentioned earlier on, yes.
On the part
what did that say, Dr. Gross, if you remember?
It's Abrahamic enthusiasm, or enthusiasm for Abraham.
Enthusiasm
yes.
for Abraham, yes, it was. Yes.
yes. The present growing interest in Islam is, I think, a very splendid move in the right direction, but it must be done in a dialogic manner, because I'm persuaded that Islam is widely misunderstood. I am also persuaded that Christianity is widely misunderstood and Judaism is widely misunderstood. So we've got mutual misunderstanding going on here. Within,
massive misunderstanding.
within and among the three Abrahamic religions. I don't think that... I heard you speaking earlier about how one could understand another religion. I don't think it's possible for me to understand Islam the way you do, because I'm outside looking in. I think there is an inner wisdom in each of these three. It's known only by the believer, the one within the community. They know things.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the outsider can observe things and be helped by the observation. But we come up with, we should come with great humility when we think about what really is Islam, or what really is Christianity, or what really is Judaism. It's the believers in those religions who they know. They know with the wisdom the outsider doesn't know. But that does not keep us from searching out these matters.
I think the point that I was emphasizing there was that it does not mean that you have to belong to a faith to understand the faith. Of course, those within the faith or within the ideology perhaps understand it much better, as you're mentioning. They are from within, from the inside, you know. They know they're not those looking at the water. They are swimming in the pool.
They're so responding, responding directly to the revelation.
They're responding directly. So my point was that I think the point I was making in the early part of why study an ideology other than your own, one of the points was, can you study another religion or a philosophy or ideology or a faith? And the point I was making was that that yes, you can. Maybe not as well. One thing that you have from the outside is objectivity, somewhat. But you also deprived. Hopefully. Yeah, not blind by prejudice or ignorance. At the same time, on the other hand, you lack the inner dimension or the inner. Being of part of the inner circle, that
the,
being
the,
what
the
it is.
The inan, is that what it's called?
Yes.
The inner religion?
Yes, yes. The very essence of being part of that inner circle. Dr. Gross, I just wish to go back and revisit the quote that I read about you with your permission before, before I introduced you, before the break. And I something that really captured my attention here, and all of it was fantastic. I remember the first time we read this at the interfaith meeting that we had. But you said, better we go out listening to the God of Abraham. Abraham. The lineaments of Abraham are in Moses' face, in the face of Jesus, in the face of Muhammad. Can you comment and elaborate a bit on that?
These numerous years I've been wrestling with these matters, as you know. And that was my attempt to say in a new way that we belong to each other through Abraham. Because I think that Abraham is in Jesus. And I see him in Muhammad and I see him in Moses. That's the heritage. And that infers indeed the one heritage which we must mutually recognize. See, it's a mutual recognition, because the mutual recognition of Abraham, that Abraham belongs to all of us, then what follows is mutual respect.
Mutual respect, yes.
At least mutual respect and even affection.
Yeah.
I think one of the astounding things about this work, Jews, Christians, and Muslims together, when it's three out of three, it brings forth amazing friendships that are a great blessing all around. And you and I know that.
Yeah.
And it's an astounding thing, and it's part of the good news. And that's why I'm here tonight with you, because I know about this good news as you do, and we want to share it.
Professor Dr. Gross, if I may, I will give you a bit of a break by reading something from... And there's a question I'll pose after this.
All right.
And this is an extract of a piece written by Professor Abdul Aziz Sakadina, who is a professor at the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Virginia. And the often asked question, which I'll be posing to you as well, there's so many numerous TV shows and programs on where this question was posed. And very often I sit back, you know, and... smirked at the question. And the more I heard it, instead of becoming more appalled by the fact that it's being asked, it made me reflect and somewhat introspect. So, the question is, where was God, you know, on September 11th? I don't want to go into the whole September 11th thing in itself right now, but what I need to look at is, you know, in the face of catastrophe, in the face of disaster, in the face of tragedy, where is God? This is the question that's asked. And he responds very, very beautifully. It's a reasonably long piece, and I beg your indulgence, if I may.
Read at least part of it.
He said,
How could I come to terms with this tragedy inflicted by human evil? Did God allow it? How could my heart be guided to God's work in this tragedy? I looked around myself as I stood to speak to thousands of students of the University of Virginia who had gathered for the candlelight vigil in the evening of September 11th. For the first time in my 25 years at the university, I saw students sitting together on the lawn as a family. I became aware of the connectedness that emerged in the community during these days. I received scores of phone calls, emails, and cards of sympathy from Christians and Jewish friends, colleagues, students, and the community at large. It was as if I was in mourning, and these were the messages of condolences. And indeed, I was in mourning for the destruction of human life and for the attack on Islam by the so-called soldiers of God. But I saw God in a newly developing relationship among people. It was the first time that I felt we had become a community in the university, in the city, and in the country as a whole. I asked, had we become so negligent about one another that God had to remind us through this tragedy that life is meaningful only when you love or you care for others? Would you like to perhaps comment on that? Or
I think it's a very beautiful statement. It comes right out of his life and his experience after September 11. I think there are a couple of things that can be observed. Where was God in this matter? Evil, when we try to explain evil, we find that we can only go so far. We can say it was caused by this, or that personality was a certain way. We can say Osama bin Laden is the evil figure and behind all this, and so on and so on. And after we've said all of that, we haven't explained it. Evil is a mystery. Now, what I offer is that goodness is a mystery. And we have seen goodness breaking out, and Professor refers to that. And then we have the matter of God bringing good out of evil. It's not to say the evil is not evil. The evil is evil. And we are very unwise not to know evil and to recognize it and recognize there is evil in this world. But the power of God to bring good out of evil goes way back. When Joseph and his brothers, you know, they threw him in a pit and he was finally taken to Egypt by Ishmaelites anyway and became prominent in the kingdom of Egypt and was put in charge of all the food when there's a great famine in the whole region. And the brothers went down to get food and they recognized their brother Joseph as the one in charge and they were very frightened. And finally they recognized one another and hugged one another and cried and so on. And he reassured his brothers who had meant evil for him by saying, I know that you intended evil for me. But God has brought out good because look at this. I am feeding thousands of people. Good out of evil. In Christianity, it is the death and resurrection of Jesus, which is the bringing of good out of evil. Mm-hmm. That's where the Christians come out on the good out of evil matter.
Mm-hmm. I think the issue that also that is comes very clearly from what Professor Abdulaziz Sakadina says here is that of course, in South Africa, we had the issue of apartheid, for example. Yes. And sometimes people were forced into communities. I mean, I'm from South Africa, as you know. And some people said, well, Islam was preserved in some way. Though we fought against apartheid, many people went to jail, people went to exile, and so on and so forth. But the fact that people were forced into particular areas solidified, united them, and brought about a kind of a galvanization of that community. And in that way, they were able to preserve some of their faith and the tradition and the culture and civilization in some way, which would have been destroyed and just engulfed by the racist regime and that was there. So some people say a good thing happened, and some people say don't use the word good with apartheid, and I understand that because from evil, no good can emanate from evil in itself, and this is where I think the face of God comes in, yes. Or the hand of God comes in. That despite the tragedy, from nothingness, God
has brought us forth. Evil is something. If from nothingness he can bring forth something, from evil, whatever that may be, that is part of the resilience of the divine nature, I think. And I think that it's not so much evil coming from good coming from evil, but even evil cannot undermine the essence of good, I think. So despite a tremendous amount of evil, a little bit of goodness will still overshadow the evil.
Well, God transforms the situation.
Transforming the situation.
Yes.
And therefore, for example, the analogy I always use, perhaps, is the idea of a dark room, and that's evil. For example, as a representation of evil. I don't mean a dark room is evil, by the way, but I mean as... And then you take a small match or a candle. It is a little bit of dark light to dispel a lot of darkness. But all the darkness in the world cannot dispel the light of a candle.
That is what the prologue to John's Gospel is saying.
Mm-hmm.
The light shines on in the darkness,
mm-hmm.
and the darkness is not able to quench it.
Quench it, yes. So there's wisdom in that. So in other words, it's not that evil is the source of goodness, but despite the evil, goodness can still emanate.
Yes.
I just wish to, I find it very beautiful, very touching, it was very moving, and you know, I just wish to read the last part of what he said. Professor Abdulaziz Kadina, of the Professor of Department of Religious Studies at the University of Virginia, continued and says, I searched through the spiritual wealth of Islam to find something that would speak to my anguish and the realization of my love and care for others. And it was in one of the poems of Jalaluddin Rumi, the Persian, great Persian Islamic philosopher and scholar, that I discovered the lines that spoke to my pain. And the lines were, sorrow prepares you for joy. It violently sweeps away everything out of your house so that new joy can find space to enter. It shakes the yellow leaves from the bough of your heart so that fresh green leaves can grow in its place. It pulls up the rotten roots so that new roots hidden beneath have room to grow. Whatever sorrow shakes from your heart, far better things will take their place. So God is everywhere, in ruins and in broken hearts, reminding us of our fragility and our short stay on this earth. And then, you know, he concludes by saying, and this is the point I would like to maybe bring up also. We live as human beings in a world of diverse beliefs, but of shared suffering. We live in a world of diverse beliefs, but of shared suffering. And much of the suffering sometimes is done in the name of God. And I'm reminded, you know, of the saying, oft-quoted, that, you know, many people are prepared to kill in the name of God, argue in the name of God, kill if they need to. But very few are prepared to live by the principles and guidelines. And that brings us back to Abraham, the pure and the upright.
All right.
You know. What is that purity that you think? What is that purity that is lacking, that is required to go back to?
I think that Abraham, the figure of Abraham, through whom God worked, is putting pressure on the monotheistic communities. And the Hebrew Scripture says that God will make great the name of Abraham. And if we make great the name of Abraham, whom we share, that will compel the three communities to reconsider their own lives, their own belief systems, mm-hmm. which may or may not be connected to the Bible or the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really calling for a reconsideration from the top to the bottom of our belief systems to see what they really do in human life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't question what's behind the belief. The revelation I don't question. I'm not challenging anybody's revelation. I'm challenging how it plays.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't played well for a while in these three communities. So the rediscovery of our family connection, to own up to the fact that we are part of that family, to accept that God intended to bless the human race mm-hmm. through that family, that it's through us,
mm-hmm.
which then does mean bless one another. I think that's the compelling matter.
We thank you, Dr. George Gross. We'll be back with Dr. George Gross after this, but we have two things to mention to you first. We have still a guest coming, a dear friend, Imam Sheikh Yasir Fazaga from the Islamic Society in Mission Viejo, the Orange County Islamic Foundation. He'll be with us towards the end of the program. And Dr. Gross will be back after the break. But before the break, we go back once again to the interview I had with the Honorable Rabbi Arnold Reckless of the University Synagogue. There after the break, don't go away. We have Dr. Gross and Sheikh Yasir Fazaga. Much more to come.
Thank you.
Beautifully said, Rabbi. One other question I would like to pose is regarding the issue of civilization. Very often civilizations are studied independently. I think we are all part on a large journey. There's a Greek, the Roman, you find, you know, the Islamic civilization. And each one impacts on the other. We are where we are, riding on the back of the previous one.
Right, right. Well, actually, you know, last week I had the privilege of being invited by you and others to share in the dedication of the mosque in okay. Irvine, and one of the things that that really struck me there, and I think this is part of my remarks, was I thanked the Muslims who were assembled, because I said that Greco-Roman civilization was preserved during the Dark Ages of Europe for both Judaism and Christianity by Islamic civilization, whether it's mathematics or philosophy. There was a golden age in the Muslim world, a lot of ignorance in the other parts of the Western world. So that's another part of this interrelationship of civilizations. We don't all grow at the same pace. Sometimes we wax and wane at different points and we get reborn, just like the moon. There's also a common symbol that we share. And I think a humility that allows us to say that there are aspects, and now I speak as a liberal Jew, if I were an Orthodox Jew, I might not speak like this, but there are aspects of every religious tradition that in any given age could be better. They don't reflect the best of that religious tradition. Religion is not just progressive. Sometimes it's regressive. And by studying other civilizations and having a healthy respect for them, we learn in certain areas of each of our traditions what we have to grow out of to become more mature in. After all, no matter what we believe revelation is or what was said or when it happened, we all know that revelation is affected by human perception.
Yes.
And once we can admit that, then we can have a humility about our own tradition and give it room to grow and be better.
God is perfect and God reveals. Human understanding is not perfect.
Right.
I appreciate that. And the one point I picked up from what you have said, Rabbi, is the importance to realize that, you know, that we are interdependent on one another. And that interdependence is very important, very necessary for us to survive as a plural society. And the other is decreasingly becoming the other. It's becoming more we, and we need to open up to that kind of thing.
Yeah, very true.
People are as foreign as, you know, as it seems, you know, Islam or Judaism. It's not foreign to America anymore.
Well, you know, I speak as a child of immigrants. I'm a first-generation American. And, you know, I have to tell you this overwhelming feeling I had, very spiritual feeling I had last week at the dedication of the mosque. And I don't mean this in any way, in a patronizing way at all. I mean this as a real sort of brother to brother here, that I thought about how in this last century, Jews emerged from a variety of civilizations around the world, and they came to America, which allowed them to have the freest expression of Judaism ever in history, and to interact with a much larger world, not a ghettoized world where they were segmented, but Judaism really blossomed in America in the 20th century. And I just had this wonderful hope for Islam that these immigrants and children of immigrants would have this experience now in Irvine and places like it all over the country, as the prejudices against Islam began to disappear. After all, there's a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism at the turn of the last century, born of ignorance, suspicion of immigrants, not seeing the world only, basically, the Americans are basically Christian, I mean, the majority society, and not knowing how to fit Judaism in. At the end of the 20th century, Judaism was comfortably in that religious mix. that is going to happen to Islam. And I just felt this is the newest wave of what we experienced in this century. That's going to happen, in fact, much more quickly in this new 21st century. And I felt very, very happy about that.
Thank you. You really enriched the program itself, being the closing remark I would maybe have from you, Rabbi, is that after September 11th, the tragedy, you know, the fact that people turn to faith, I want to look at that part of it. I assumed when it happened, I hope it's not an Israeli or a Palestinian or someone, and then it'll be an anti-Muslim, anti-Christian, right, or anti-Jewish thing. Right. Despite the people who are said to be behind the whole thing, somehow religion is linked to this whole issue. The point is that people turn to faith. You know, you'd assume the people who say, you see, religion, this is just... And people begin to realize and acknowledge the fact that very often we are prepared to kill in the name of faith, though abusingly so.
Yes.
But not live by it.
Right.
Yeah. This is very phenomenal, very strange to me. And it was very unique and very heartwarming, though. But I couldn't really grasp it initially. How do you respond to that particular aspect that people actually turn more to faith? You know?
Well, I think part of that is what I said earlier about the cosmos against chaos, right? They felt chaos. Religion was seen as providing order, structure, comfort, community, even if not always answers. Some people go to religion for answers. I go to religion for questions. I think questions are more interesting than answers. We have to always figure out our answers in response to the tradition and modernity. But September 11th, I think two things happened in regard to Islam on September 11th. I think one is, and again I say this in the spirit of brotherhood, that I think Muslims understood, as every other religious group had to understand, that extremists are never benign. You know, I mean, all other religious traditions have extremists. They have people practice violence in the name of faith, and until we're challenged to deal with that issue, we kind of think they're marginal, they're crazy, they're an irritant. Mm. We don't even want to get near them because they're so different than us. But I think one thing the Muslim community learned is you can't pretend they're not there. You've got to deal with them, and you've got to reiterate to the flock that we can have no tolerance for this kind of extremism. The other issue is a challenge to America to not descend into cheap and quick prejudice and bigotry, and to understand the grandeur and greatness of Islam, and to see it as one of the three great faiths of America. And of course, there are many more than three faiths here, but coming from Western tradition, three faiths, and to find ways to integrate Islam as a religion into the mosaic of American religion. You know, there was one time when interfaith meant Protestant and Catholic, and then it meant Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish. And now it's beginning to mean Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, and hopefully it will continue to mean Hindu, Buddhist, Baha'i, etc. Even the National Conference for Christians and Jews changed its name to the National Community for Justice. Yeah. So National Conference for Community and Justice, yeah. And that's very healthy. America will be a better society as it opens its windows and doors to Islam and other traditions.
We thank Rabbi Arnold Reckless from the University Synagogue here in Irvine. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you indeed, Rabbi Arnold Reckless. And we are here, a final comment from Dr. George Gross. Dr. George Gross is from the Academy of Judaic, Christian, and Islamic Studies, and he teaches a course program at the at UCLA, The Abrahamic Religions in the 21st Century and the Clash of Civilizations. The Abrahamic Religions in the 21st Century and the Clash of Civilizations, a course which is conducted by and organized and spearheaded by Dr. George Gross at UCLA. Doctor, final comments, a minute or so to wrap up. I think the rabbi referred to it as well, the significance of the need for understanding and tolerance.
I think we must encourage one another to engage one another in dialogue. I think to back away from dialogue at this time is a great blunder. There are some in our society who would like to walk away from dialogue. We've been talking about the more positive aspects, but there are people in Islam and Judaism and Christianity who want to have nothing to do with the other ones. And they see September 11 and all that the anguish that that caused as sufficient reason for disengaging. And such would be a tremendous spiritual blunder. We must further engage because we're family. And it is very much the case in the Christian churches that they are encapsulated in that they are little engaged with Judaism and Islam as churches. On the whole, there are many good things happening, but they are limited in scope.
More needs to happen at the larger scale.
Much more on a very vast scale. We must engage one another in dialogue and not back away from it. And then also, for our own self-understanding, when we say we're making a quotation mm-hmm. out of some piece of some document or mm-hmm. some piece of literature, mm-hmm. we say to one another, now be careful, don't take it out of context. Mm-hmm. And as it stands, in much of our interior religious life, in the synagogues, the mosques, and the churches, we are trying to do it out of context. Mm-hmm. Because the context for the Christian church is Judaism and Islam. That's our context. Mm-hmm. When Christianity started out, it was the Greco-Roman world and the Jewish people. Now it's changed a little bit. Islam is part of the context. Mm-hmm. And we will, in our time, distort Christianity, speaking as a Christian, mm-hmm. if we try to do Christianity without acknowledging, welcoming, and learning from, and sharing in the context around us, who are the Jews and the Muslims, both.
Which is our reality.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Dr. George Gross, from the Academy of Judaic Christian Islamic Studies at UCLA. As I mentioned, has a course at the UCLA on the Abrahamic religions in the 21st century and the clash of civilizations. Thank you very much, Dr. George Gross. It's really a pleasure to have
Sheikh
you.
Sadullah.
And we will be back sometime, wherever we are. We're always together, and I'll get you back on the program, I'm sure.
That
I enjoy it tremendously.
Thank you.
Don't go away. After this, after the break, we'll have Sheikh Yasir Fazaga from the Orange County Islamic Foundation, the Islamic Mission Viejo Mosque. We have the last hour dealing with Muslim response to September 11th and also Islam in America pre-September 11th and post-September 11th and the way forward. Don't go away. After the break, I'll see you. Welcome to Cal State University, Dominguez Hills. We are live here, and we have with us an honored guest, a dear friend, Sheikh Yasir Fazaga of the Orange County Islamic Foundation and Imam of the Mission Viejo Mosque in Mission Viejo. Welcome, Sheikh Yasir Fazaga.
Thank you.
Peace be upon you, and as we say, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
That's a very common greeting. As you know, Muslims greet one another with a greeting of peace, which means may the peace and the blessings of God be upon each and every one. Let me just begin, Sheikh Yasir, before we go to the Imam, just to a few points we mentioned early on. And the question I would like to pose to the respected scholar here is, living as Muslims in America pre-9/11, before we go to the aftermath of the tragedy. One of the things that was very, very strange and unique, and I said the unprecedented amount of people inquiry about Islam, an unprecedented amount of people who embrace Islam. Even at the highest level, you find, not only in America, even beyond America, the Rome's envoy to Arabia converted to Islam. For example, Italy's ambassador to Saudi Arabia, you know, Torquato Cardile, and so on. And 36,000 people. There was a number of libraries that ran out of Muslim books, Islamic books. You know, it's all, if you went to a higher or borrow books from there, it was taken, there's none left. Then you went to bookshops. And I remember going the week or two after September 11th to well-known bookshops in Glendale and so on in Pasadena, and the regular books on Islam which were standing there on shelves, you know, and I left them there 2 weeks ago, they were still there, not found. There were 3-4 copies, not a single one found. The question, Imam Yasir Fazaga, is twofold. First of all, what do you think sparked this kind of interest? Obviously, the tragedy is something, but it was not only that people shirked away from it, people actually engaged it. They wanted to learn more and know more. What are your feelings on this, Sheikh?
Well, I think that was a very positive outcome of the tragedy itself, and that is people just became more curious to want to know more about Islam. In our own Islamic centers, the number of phone calls that we received, the number of people that actually drove by, the number of people that sent us flowers, people who are genuinely interested in learning about Islam. And it's very interesting because America, I think, throughout their history with Islam, that the way people found out about Islam was always, unfortunately, through headline news. Mm-hmm. Beginning with the oil embargo, then going on to the bombing in Lebanon, then going on to the Gulf War, then going on the hostage crisis in Iran and what have you. So that was the only way that people were finding out about Islam. Islam was never understood or looked at as a religion. And then, of course, came
Syria's
the night.
Religion. Exactly. The other is their thing, the Middle Eastern thing.
Exactly. It was never considered. And the only time, again, that the name Muslim or Islam came up was when there was a catastrophe taking place. So what happened is, again, 9/11 was no different. But this time, I think the media did a good job, actually, in telling people that do not equate Islam with terrorism. Mm-hmm. People started saying, why are the Muslims doing this to us? Why are the Muslims doing this? So people really wanted to know, what is it about Islam that is making people feel the way they feel about that? Why are we so resented and what have you? And interestingly, I was listening to a story that a young girl was watching television with her mother. And she was watching the planes diving into the World Trade Center. So she looked at her and she said, Mom, who did this to us? And she said, some people, and she said, why did they do it? And she said, well, it's because they hate us, honey. And she said, well, why do they hate us? She said, well, it's because they don't know us. She said, well, Mom, can we just write our names on a piece of paper and hand it to them? And I think that's what most people did. They really wanted, and of course, differently, they just wanted to learn more about us. And it's just that curiosity factor, I believe, has sparked it.
And a tremendous amount of interest. I mean, the amount of inquiry and also the sense of community. You know, I'm just here for 3.5 years. I mean, but even in the 3.5 years, I've been involved in dialogue, and you're in the big mosque that you are in, involved with dialogue and hosting people. But really the genuine interest, not just showing sympathy and, well, you know, we are your neighbors kind of thing, but really genuinely people interested in trying to care and share. Of course, we have had some backlashes. Of course, we saw what happened. And also by some very often on ignorance. The first person killed was a Sikh person of a different faith who happened to wear a turban and had a beard. Someone in San Diego was an Arab Christian.
Right.
And that's the other part of it, I think, that we have a responsibility, whether Christian, Jewish or Muslim, and in our case now being Muslim, to inform, because very often people, as you mentioned, the media, and we have a question here, by the way, that we have from there, and we want to thank the people who called during the break to support the program and give comments, but we would like you to also ask some questions and engage us. I'm sure that you don't agree with everything we say, or you could enhance by your comments something. So people have phoned in. We thank the callers who called during the break, but have just passed comments and commended the program. But we also wish to have some questions live, if you wish, via email, or you can phone, and the number flashes on the screen. It's 1-800-339-1193 that we have it there. We have a question about the media. You know, and very often the question, does the Quran promote violence and so on and so forth? And of course, I will be dealing with that particular question about the Quran and violence somewhat down the line when I deal with the Quran, a scripture central to the Islamic tradition. Yes, the Quran, it was revealed in a historical context, in a real setting, and it was engaged, it was suppressed. The Muslims were suppressed as Jesus was, as Moses was. And of course, in that condition, there were declarations that were made that were necessary revelations that were meant to meet the needs of the time, as well as some principles that were guiding principles for all the time. So this, the Quran doesn't promote violence, but of course, it promotes the idea of justice. It wants peace, but peace cannot grow or exist in the absence of justice. So I will be dealing with the question, but as a general answer, the Quran by itself does not promote violence, as I believe no other sacred text does. But one of the interesting points is that on the one hand there is an accusation that people misrepresent the faith, or misinform others, or they distort the truth. And then there's also misrepresentation by people of the faith. Sometimes people, behave in a manner, isolate themselves from others. And I think the Muslim community hasn't really been doing that. I think we have been inclusive thus far. But what has your experience been prior to September the 11th? How would you describe, the presence of Islam here, particularly in Southern California?
Yeah, I think there's also a point that, honestly, it has to be said, and that is, most religions, if not all, we all had our fair share of abusing and misusing the name of God. Mm-hmm. I don't think Muslims are exceptions. Jews, Christians, we all have done it. And that is why Islam, the way religiosity is concerned, is how does it impact you? Mm-hmm. Because if what you believe in does not impact how you behave, then probably it's not very important. Mm-hmm. And that is why the aim of Islam is to establish that relationship
faith
with God.
And action.
Exactly. That will manifest itself in action with the way you deal with the rest of humanity. Prior to September 11th, I think Muslims, we were really making a big time progress. It was beautiful. The number of Islamic mosques was really, really growing in the United States. I think we are at about 1,900 Islamic centers now. The number of Muslim schools was also growing. The number of Muslim organizations were growing. We were a lot more active in the political arena, in the social services, in our own local communities. So I think that a lot was gained before September 11th. And I think that progress was also highly witnessed, be it in the number of the Islamic centers or just be it in the activities that Muslims were involved in.
Okay, now we come to the question that you somewhat alluded to, and I'm going to read two quotes, if I may, with your permission, Sheikh.
Sure.
I'm reading here, Islam is not America's enemy, and it's written by Claire Britton Warren. And she writes, since the terrible atrocity of September 11th, the beliefs and practices of Islam and Muslims, those who follow the path of Islam, have been under intense scrutiny, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. As Americans, we need to understand who our enemy is, and even more important, who our enemy is not.
Mm-hmm.
Very well put, I think.
Oh, yes.
Much
yes.
of the media's focus in relation to the question the question asks has been on the religious beliefs of the terrorists. Sadly, the terrorist groups have used their religious beliefs in an attempt to justify their actions. They have actually committed a terrible crime against the Muslim community. Now, that's one part. Then I have a scholar of Islam, a respected friend of mine from the Hebrew Union College, is Rabbi Reuven Firestone, is the author of the book Jihad, The Origin of Holy War in Islam. And he's the professor of medieval Judaism and Islam at the Hebrew Union College. He's a scholar of Islam as well. And he, the same question I posed to Dr. Gross early on, was where was God? And he said, whom can you trust if not God? But God has also been manipulated. And this is the saddest aspect of the complex we call the Middle East, and referring to the whole situation. God has been hijacked by terrorists all across. God has been hijacked by terrorists. Islam is not the problem. Terrorism is the problem. And terrorists have hijacked both Islam and God. Now, I said pre-September 11th and post-September 11th. But September 11th itself, I think, was a great awakening for people to value their lives, value what we have, the fragile nature of life, the uncertainty of life, and so on and so forth. And also for a great nation, that can take on the world, and here people were, barehanded, were able to do something, the unthinkable. Now, it has brought us closer to reality. It has made people realize, appreciating what we have, knowing where we are, but also questioning, where are we going to? How do you personally, as an Islamic scholar and as an Islamic leader, and as a community leader, how did that tragedy, that incident, being Muslim first of all, being American, being part of the community, being part of the kaleidoscope of what is America, how did you as a person respond to that?
I've never felt, as Muslims, whenever we talk to one another, we speak of the importance of reaching out to the community, make people aware of us, tell people about who we are, so that in case something like this happens, people are would not equate what took place with who we really are. But that was never, unfortunately, and this I think one of the mistakes of the Muslim community, it was never implemented into action. And when it was very minimum. Mm-hmm. But then after September 11th, there was that, eagerness to really wanting to reach out to the community and just really be a member and be part of it, because the people that were mass murdered, they were innocent people. And I'm not sure if you know this or not, but there was actually an Islamic center in the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. About 1,500 people would pray there on Fridays. But I think it was about the government of Pakistan, Muslim mm-hmm. government, mm-hmm. they had an office there. So did the people of Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. So did about 400 companies that belonged to Muslims. And that is why I say that what took place was mass murder, where people just wanted to kill, period. And after September the 11th, as a center, and I felt that that was very important as an imam or a community leader, if you want to call it that, that there is that need. We must reach out to people. And the way people were very receptive of us was actually very beautiful. We had a triple celebration in one of the synagogues in Aliso Viejo on December the 9th, I believe. And it was beautiful that Muslims were celebrating Ramadan. Our friends, Judaism, they were celebrating Hanukkah. And Christians were celebrating Advent. And I think about 700 people showed up mm-hmm. in that event. Mm-hmm. And it showed that we have our theological differences. And that is not, exactly. And that's not what we came there for, you know, to resolve. But the idea was, let not the theological differences that we have with other people stopping us from being decent human beings with one another. And I think that is one of the most beautiful outcomes of this tragedy that took place on September the 11th. Mm-hmm. People came to the mosque, we went to churches and synagogues. So I think it's that reaching out part that I believe was mm-hmm. was very important, and it was beautifully done and accomplished.
Okay. I think we have a call on the line. Will you go through to a call on the line?
Hello.
Hello, sir. Go ahead. Who's calling in? From where are you calling, sir?
Yeah, my name is Sultan from Culver City in California.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was listening to a very good discussion between you and Dr. Gross.
Yes.
And thank you very much for the knowledge. You referred about the verse in Quran about the religion of Prophet Abraham.
Yeah.
Peace be upon him and all the prophets.
Yeah.
It's the verse 67 in Surah Imran,
right.
Third Surah in Quran.
Right.
Which in English translates as Abraham was neither a Jew nor a Christian, which you translated right.
Right.
But he was a true Muslim, Hanifan.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the same Surah, in verse 85,
yeah.
Quran, Allah states that,
yeah.
and whosoever seeks religion
yeah.
other than Islam,
mm.
it will never be accepted of him.
Yes.
And in the hereafter, yeah. he will be one of the losers.
Okay.
Then in the same surah, about Jesus sitting with the disciples, and he asked the disciples, who will be my helper in the cause of Allah? Mm-hmm. And they answered, that be a witness
yeah.
that we are Muslims.
I thank you for that. I get the drift of the question. The question was, I think, from the quotations that you are giving and from what you have said at the beginning, that the reference made by Dr. Gross and to which I responded was the particular ما كان إبراهيم يهودية ولا نصرانية ولكن كان حنيفا مسلما. The point that Gross made was that Abraham belongs to everyone, to all the Jews, Christians and Muslims. And his point was that that he reiterated a few times through his discussion and our discussion here, was that Abraham, when you came, the Jews claim him to be their Abraham, or the Muslim claim to be their Abraham, and the Christian claim him to be their Abraham, it is exclusive, that no one else shares him. And he was talking about the sharing of Abraham. And the verse in the Quran, I said, says that Ibrahim was neither Jew nor Christian, ولكن كان حنيفة. Hanifa is not only one place that's used in the Quran about Ibrahim or about faith in that sense. It implies that anybody of faith, and of course we say Muslim, you don't submit, one who submit to Allah. want to submit to God, one fulfills the commandments of God, who has true faith, who has abided with the truth, principles of justice and goodness, and manifests that, as the Imam mentioned early on, in practical behavior. Now, each tradition will, for example, particularly emphasize mutually exclusive right, that this is the way ultimately, and a Muslim believes that, a Christian believes that, and a Jew believes that. That's not the debate that we are engaging here. The point was, how do we share Abraham? Do we share him as being, well, he's a Muslim, got nothing to do with you guys. So in that regard, I said, is Hanifan Muslima. Muslim in that he submits to Allah as all Muslims are supposed to be. He's not just a Muslim by name. Well, I'm a Muslim, but I'm a mad, bad Muslim. I may be a murderer, I may be a thief, but I'm a Muslim. Ibrahim was a Muslim in that sense. He was one who really submitted to Allah. And that's why prior to the word Muslim, Hanif is used. And the word Hanif is used very deliberately with Ibrahim alayhi salam on more than one occasion in the Quran. So the idea of Hanif is the idea of pure. So I said, yes, as Muslims, Muslims generally, our belief is that all prophets in essence came with the same message and all brought the message of submission to the will of God. In that sense, they're all Muslim. So Ibrahim was Muslim as in that sense of being submissive to the will of God, as all people of faith, or all people who abide by the revelations that come down throughout history and abide by those principles are submitted to the will of God if they implement it. But at the same time, I was emphasizing the word Hanif, that he wasn't Muslim just purely in the sense of being called a Muslim, but one who really submitted to the will of Allah, the will of God, and fulfilled his commandments. I want to come to a point here that, in addition to the discussion that we had, that, you know, the terrorist attack does not represent Islam. This is the point that you made. And there's a BBC report that I'm looking at. It's about Muhammad Ali, what he said, and this is, quote, terrorist attacks does not represent Islam. Perhaps the greatest sports hero, and I read here, in America, and possibly in the world, is a Muslim. His name is Muhammad Ali, the boxing champion, non-parallel. We have Muslims for whom we have cheered or continue to cheer in America, from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in basketball to Ahmad Rashab, the former football player who is now a broadcaster. The man named the best soccer player on earth the last 2 years, a worldwide hero, was voted the most popular man in France, is a Muslim, Zinedine Zidane, and so on. Muhammad Ali said, you know, and asked someone, asked him, how do you feel that someone from your faith has done this? He responded to the person, how do you feel that someone from your faith had done the Holocaust? But the point is, it does not minimize the evil that occurred. He said, Muhammad Ali said, I'm a Muslim and I'm an American. If the culprits who perpetrated this are Muslims and they have twisted the teachings of Islam, whoever performed or is behind the attacks does not represent Islam, for God is not behind assassins. This is some of the quotations which has been reiterated. One of the problems that I found, again, one of the problems that I had with the issue of September 11th was that you are guilty by association, someone, mm-hmm. that you are Muslim. Like, I'm from Africa, I was born in Africa, though my forefathers may have come from the Far East, but I'm a proud African. And this idea of the other, we are here and everyone belongs somewhere else, and in Los Angeles in particular, everyone is the other. I mean, if you say a Los Angelino, stand up, you wouldn't know he's black, green, white, pink, yellow, Arabic speaking, English speaking. I mean, very few people speak English. Many people speak Spanish or another language as well, as their first language for that matter, or another home language. But one of the things that I found was that very often you were considered guilty by association. By being Muslim, you must be bearded, maybe you're linked to an Arab, maybe somewhat, Arab, Muslim fundamentalist, terrorist, and you're on the other side. One of the things that I think people don't understand, yeah, I think we have another call on the line. Sorry, we'll come back to that. We give the callers preference. Sure. Go ahead. State your name and your question.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Fadula Khan.
Yes.
A few minutes ago, there was a person who came on the telephone and he cited a verse from the Quran about Sayyidina Ibrahim.
Yeah.
لم يكن يهوديا ولا مسيحيا بل كان مسلما حنيفا.
Yeah.
Okay. وهو سماكم هو سمان المسلمين.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question here regarding the way you interpreted this verse, explaining it.
Yeah.
You have reversed back to the mistaken or the wrong understanding mm-hmm. that there is a difference, that mm-hmm. there are Christians, there are Jews, and there are Muslims, mm-hmm. whereas I believe that this verse actually unifies mm-hmm. that Muhammad, Sayyidina Muhammad, Sayyidina Isa, mm-hmm. Sayyidina Musa, mm-hmm. All of them were Muslims, all are of one faith, of one book. saying the same thing, and that is exactly what that verse quotes. Is that correct?
Thank you very much for the question. Yeah, I mean, the question is we're trying to compartmentalize it. You are saying, for example, now that all of these believe in one book. I mean, which book did Musa alayhi salam? He didn't have the Quran with him. Jesus didn't have the Quran with him, for example. So, I mean, they didn't pray the five prayers the way we pray five prayers. So they were Muslim, of course, in submitting to the will of God. And I need to understand this. I get the impression that the idea of Hanifa Muslima is now meant that maybe I took it out of context. And no, I'm not meaning that. I'm saying submitting to the will of God is being Muslim. Believing all the prophets, culminating in the mission of Prophet Muhammad, is Muslim in the sense that we understand Muslim, and as the Muslim that I am, and assume the Muslim that you are. But when the question was posed, and I need you to understand, the question was, discussion that you had was, is Abraham shareable? So if we say he's a Muslim, that means he was not a Christian, and Christians won't have anything to do with him, or they can have nothing to do with him, or such. Or Jews may claim that. So the point was, yes, he submitted to the will of God, he was Muslim in that sense. And he's part of the tradition of prophets. All prophets were part of one tradition who were commissioned to convey the message of God to guide humanity at large. That's another point. The third point I want to make is that he was Hanif. He was truly a Muslim. Not just Muslim, well, I read the Kalima and I pray and I've been for Hajj, but I'm the biggest cheat, I'm a liar, and so on and so forth, have no moral values. Otherwise, for example, and then say, well, he's a Muslim like me. I'm trying to say the emphasis on Hanif. Of course, the Christians say he was of their tradition. The Jewish say that he was that. And Muslims say, well, he's part of our tradition. I accept that. I get that very clear. I was referring to the Hanif part, that perhaps we should look at the purity of him being Muslim. The purity of Hanif. And Moses was a Muslim too, or Jesus was a Muslim too, according to the understanding that we have, and from what you have mentioned right now. But he was Hanif. Are we Hanif Muslim, like Jesus, like Moses, like Muhammad? No. So I was emphasizing the point of Hanif. And I hope that is clearly understood in this regard. I thank the caller, Jamila from Santa Monica.
Actually, Sheikh, there was an interesting article on National Geographic.
Oh, beautiful, yes.
On Abraham. I think it was the December 2001 issue.
Yes.
And the article was very well written in a sense that what does Ibrahim mean to the Muslims, to the Jews, and to the Christians? Mm-hmm. And like you said, we can have all the fight that we want about who has more right to claim Ibrahim.
Yes.
But like you said, I think the most compelling part of Ibrahim alayhi salam is the fact that he was Hanif.
Yes.
He put his faith into action. His faith manifested in that.
In a very clear and distinct way. And of course, even the whole Hajj that we have is partly a celebration and a reenactment of some of the things of Ibrahim alayhi salam, of Ibrahim, peace be upon him, of Ismail and Hajira.
Yes.
And you know, the running of Hajira and the sacrifice of Ismail. I mean, of course, Muslims believe that Ismail was sacrificed among the Jewish and Christian traditions. Isaac was sacrificed. So, of course, I accepted Ismail before the caller thinks that I changed that. I'm saying we accept that. The fact that we agree that he was prepared to sacrifice his son, the sacrifice is the important thing right now. I believe it's Ismail and accept it's Ismail. Jews and Christians believe otherwise. Who it was does not matter to me right now, though I believe it to be Ismail. The important issue is that he was prepared to sacrifice. And that is the example that we need to look at. And this is the point I'm trying to focus upon. And I hope it's understood by the listeners in that
regard.
And
you know, if you continue with the verses that were recited, that the prayers of Ibrahim alayhi salam was لِيُزَكِّيهِمْ وَيُطَهِّرُهُمْ so that he may purify them and make them, you know, better people.
Yeah, better people.
And the idea is, how do you respond to that call of Ibrahim alayhi salam? How does that manifest itself?
Itself, yes.
You know,
Now, one of the things that I need to bring to our attention, and we don't have too much time, I thought 3 hours is a long time, and time goes so quick. And I appreciate your coming. We are with Sheikh Yasir Fazaga of the Orange County Islamic Foundation, Imam of the Mission Viejo Mosque. I think we have a caller. Please go ahead, state your name and your point, please.
We lost the call.
The two callers we lost. But thank you anyway for the callers who are calling in. And also for those who called during the break to, commend the program and for their goodwill and well wishes. Thank you very much. One of the points that we need to look at is, and you have alluded to that somewhat, is the importance of understanding one another. One of the problems that we have is that the interfaith and intrafaith
interfaith and interfaith. I have a caller. Let's go back to the caller, please. State your name and from where you're calling, and brief question, please, or comment. Thank you.
Yes. Hello.
We have Joyce.
Yes, this is Joyce calling from downtown LA. Professor Sadowar?
Yes.
I would like to just thank you for this wonderful program that you're having. It's very informative.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. My question is, I know that the leadership of the three faiths, they are doing a lot to work together and combine and do a lot to explain the faith to
people. You mean the Jews, Christians, and Muslims? You mean three faiths, those three faiths?
Yes, I am.
Right.
That's exactly what I mean. I'd like to know, the common man in the street, what can we do to enhance this understanding?
As students and as people, you mean, in general?
Yeah, just as the common man in the street, basically, yeah.
It's a very good question, Sheikh. What, religious people are coming together. We are sitting together today. We had a Jewish, Christian, Muslim guests and so on coming together. But how does the community, it's a very, I think, good question that we have.
You know, I am a fan of reading bumper stickers, believe it or not.
Bumper stickers, yeah.
And every time I see a car with a bumper sticker, I won't follow it and I read,
Yeah, don't bump it
there. No, I usually don't. And one of the most beautiful bumper stickers I read, a sign that said, act locally and think globally.
Act locally and think globally, yes.
And I thought it was very, very beautiful, because sometimes we have a tendency that we want to fix everything, everywhere,
Now.
But that is never doable.
Yes.
And see, these programs, they are little, but as they say, big things happen when little things are done right.
Yeah.
Informing yourself about others, introducing yourself to other people, and just, learning and being acquainted with people who are different than you are, I think that is a big help. And like I think it was the rabbi that said it earlier, to live in Orange County is something that is, or maybe Southern California, let's say, is just amazing. It would be the most diverse place on earth.
Yes.
And the way to take advantage of this is to get to know other people.
I mean, now, the other thing that I think we need to look at, I thank Joyce for the call from Los Angeles, and it was a thank you for the question, and for the kind comment and sentiments expressed. One of the problems that I have observed in dealing with people of faith in general, and my experience has shown that sometimes you find that there is an easier access to interfaith dialogue and cooperation than intrafaith. People from different faiths somewhat could come together much easily, but within a faith tradition, do you find, I think in America we don't have it so much pronounced as you may find in other parts. I know in South Africa, for example, you may find the Dutch Reformed Church and the Catholics, the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa supported apartheid, for example. So we understand that. But how do you feel? I mean, how this idea of a shared civilization, a shared heritage, talking with Jews and Christians and everyone else, it's interfaith and it's good and we should do that. What's your feeling about the difficulties encountered in intrafaith, within faiths?
I think for the first example, or for the first part of the question, is that sometimes people feel that if they do participate in these interfaith meetings, they must be compromising part of their religion.
Yeah.
And that is never the case.
And there's the impression I get from the first caller that I was compromising the Quranic verse to try to say Abraham wasn't Muslim, for example, and that's not the emphasis on Hanif.
Right.
Okay, fine.
And that's the thing. Mm-hmm. People walk in here, or it is us going somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I walk in as a Muslim, I walk out as a Muslim, not having to really compromise any part of my religion. Other people did not have to do the same as well. So the idea is, when people come together, it is not necessarily a place where people must compromise their religion. They get to keep their religion. The idea is, let us get to know one another better. And they have a saying that is so beautiful. They say that ignorance breeds fear. Mm-hmm. And I believe this happens many times. Mm-hmm. People are so ignorant about one another to the point where they are, for no good reason, were so fearful of one another. Mm-hmm. And the only way that this can be addressed is by coming together. And like you said, I think initially we had a problem with the Muslim community. And like you said, we're willing to sit with people who were from different faith, but then within us, it was a little bit more
complex.
Exactly, and it was more problematic. Mm-hmm. And I suppose
the same amongst other faiths too. I think that amongst the Jews and Christians, perhaps the same thing. I don't know.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yes. I mean,
Why is that so? I just want to know, in your experience, and why do you find that? I mean, here you're talking about a shared civilization, a shared heritage, and you can...
I think the way people will justify it is, these people are not aware of my books, so I am to be nice to them so that I make them aware of my books. Yes. But these people, though they know the truth, yet they are distorting it.
Yeah. And the other thing also, I think, with the intra-faith is that, you know, you have a monolithic idea. This is the right way, the way I've been taught about this. Exactly. Is the way I think. And if anybody thinks outside this, they're misrepresenting the faith, or they're selling out.
Right.
Then you say this kind of thing. How can you say that? I know this, one day I was speaking to a mixed audience, and I used the word Jesus, peace be upon him. And someone said, well, why do you say Isa? The Quran uses the word Isa. I said, but it's the same Jesus. And no, but why are you saying that? You know, I said, but if I said Isa, they wouldn't know who it is. And that's why I said Isa. I said Jesus too, both of them. But what I mean is this, you know, this idea that, you know, if you say Jesus, it's not the same Isa anymore.
Right.
If you say Moses, you're not saying Musa anymore.
Right.
I said the name in itself is sacred rather than what it represents. If you say Moses or Mary, for example, in a mixed audience, to a predominantly Muslim audience, there's no harm. So this is, I mean, the focus. And I think sometimes the idea of trying to think that my perspective is the only perspective, and fear if anybody thinks otherwise, they're deviating and it must be stopped. It's blasphemy. This is, I think, part of the reasons why within faith we have a problem.
Yes, by all means.
We have a caller, Imam Yasir. Please go ahead. Who's calling? State your name and the place from where you're calling. Layla from West Los Angeles, and your question, please.
Good evening.
Welcome, Layla.
Thank you. I'm calling to ask, what is the difference between jihad and ijtihad? This is something that I've been trying to explain to people for some time, but I'd like to get a clear definition from you.
Yeah, well, we're lucky we have Sheikh Yasir here. But yes, in fact, later down the line, in one of the programs we'll be having later on, in maybe three or four lectures, next week, by the way, we'll have the fundamentals of faith, and thereafter, Islam's contribution to civilization. And then we'll go into some of the details and aspects of things like Quran, what is the Islamic sacred text and the prophetic personality, as well as the Quran in world literature. And one of the points is the whole issue of Sharia, Islamic law, and so on, and the whole on what it is based. And of course, Ijtihad is one of the bedrocks of Islamic law. Well, literally, both of them come from the same root. Mm-hmm. Both come from jihad, which means to strive for excellence. The word jihad in itself means striving for excellence. It can imply an internal struggle for purification. It can imply a struggle for the welfare of the community. It can imply a struggle to assist others in whatever way you can. But also at the same time, it can imply taking up arms if needs be to defend the truth and the justice, for example. And that may be also part of what jihad could be. But jihad doesn't mean holy war in itself, because holy war is harbul muqaddas, and the word harbul muqaddas doesn't appear neither in the Quran nor in the prophetic tradition as a word or as a term. So holy war is an important term from the crusade, and it's not an Islamic term in itself. So jihad, the word literally, you are correct there, dear sister Layla, that yes, jihad and ijtihad from a similar root. They come from juhud, which means striving for excellence. However, and Sheikh Yasir could help me out and elaborate on this, but on the one hand, jihad is a striving of the self for something greater than the self. Ijtihad, on the other hand, is striving with your mental faculties and your ability and your knowledge that you have to strive to find a legal solution to a problem. Mm-hmm. So ijtihad means exercising your intellect and using the available resources, and primarily making reference to the, in Islamic terms, to the Quranic and prophetic tradition, to the Quran and Hadith, which are the primary sources, which is the revelation of God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the traditions of the Prophet, his words, his deeds, his actions, his approvals and disapprovals. Those are the Hadith. These are the primary sources. And then, when you have a new situation arriving, for example, you have cloning. Now, the Quran doesn't say anything about cloning, nor does the Hadith say anything. And the scholar, qualified scholar who have gone through the traditional studies and not necessarily traditional studies, but have gone through studies of Quran and qualified to engage those kind of issues, looking at the relevant question of the time, looking at the text, and then exercising his or her understanding of that text to apply it to the contingency which has arisen. Sheikh, maybe you can add something on that?
Yeah, like you said, it is the ability to be able to deduce a new ruling, mm-hmm, with regard to a novel case that was not necessarily addressed as clearly in the Quran or the prophetic sayings, traditions of the Prophet. So the idea is someone would have to meet these qualifications by which they can, of course, they have to be aware of what it is that is being discussed or the question that is addressed, and looking into the resources that we have
available,
and coming to what is thought to be an Islamic answer to that specific question or that novel case that came up.
So jihad is the striving and the struggling for excellence, struggling for something greater than yourself, struggling, you know, for the social welfare of the community, for the moral and spiritual improvement of the society, and more so of yourself, and at times defending the, at times also, of course, defending the truth, fighting for justice, and it requires at times even in some circumstances to take up arms if needs be, if needs be.
Okay. Oh, it's a very beautiful concept of that course. Islam that Islam puts.
Yes, and of course, ijtihad, as the Sheikh mentioned, applying our understanding and using the textual reference and the frame, the Quran and the prophetic tradition as a frame of reference to address a new issue that has arisen and respond to it with the spirit of the tradition of the Prophet and the Quranic guidelines. I wish to inform you that we are going off air in 2 or 3 minutes before I ask Sheikh Yasir Fazaga to give his closing comments. Remember, we are live from Khalsa University, Domingo Hills, the SBS 318 course. I'm Sadullah Khan, and we have with us Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, one of our guests and my dear friend from the Orange County Islamic Foundation. And we are coming live to you from Khalsa Domingo Hills University on DHTV and, of course, on the internet. Please, next week I expect you to call in. We are going to be dealing with the fundamentals of Islamic faith, the pillars of faith and so on. So we begin to dealing with Islam in itself and the traditions of the Prophet, prophetic personality and his impact on civilization, as well as the Quran as a religious text and as part of world literature, as well as dealing with the contribution of Islam towards civilization and Islam in America and so on and so forth. We'll be dealing with all of that, a major chunk of the program towards the end. The course would be on Islam in America and those aspects. So please feel free to call us. You have the number 1-800-339-1193. And this is the SBS 318 course. And we're offering this as a service to the community, even those who are not registered students, though you may register. And of course, the information will appear towards the end. You are welcome to phone in, to participate, to question, to send in faxes, to send in emails, and to engage us and to inform us or to learn from what we have perhaps said. Now, one of the major programs we'll be doing is Islamic Civilization a bit later on. I just wish to have final remarks from Sheikh Yasir Fazaga, and with which we will eventually play out. And the question is, what is the way forward?
I think that we have
10 seconds.
Sure. I think that Muslims, we have an excellent opportunity right now. People want to learn about us, and it is time that we make use of this opportunity and present ourselves better to people, and also to undo what took place on September the 11th.
I thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And we are still awake. I hope you are. See you next week. Same place, same time.